opened Fresh Air today with a 1933 recording featuring Benny Carter's band. The tune was called Six Bells Stampede. Sociologist E. Digby Baldsell has spent many years studying the upper class of America. In 1958, his book Philadelphia Gentlemen suggested that the upper class way of life in Philadelphia had become more of an end in itself than a means to authority and power. His new book, Puritan Boston and Quaker Philadelphia, compares the leadership styles, personal values, and goals of the upper classes in both cities, and talks about how the upper classes have affected the character of each city. Baltzel, who is himself a Philadelphian, will join us on Fresh Air today at 4 o'clock. One of the great examples of Americana is the large body of Currier and Ives lithographs from the 19th century. These color prints ranged from sentimentalized family portraits to renderings of disastrous fires and images of the technological breakthroughs of the period, like railroads. A history of Currier and Ives has been written by Walton Rawls. He'll be joining us at about 3:40 today. At 3, we continue our series on how the media portrays doctors and lawyers, and how these presentations influence our perception of the legal and medical professions. Joining me now on Fresh Air is Elaine Tate, food editor for the Philadelphia Inquirer. She's also the author of a new restaurant guide called Best Restaurants, Philadelphia and Environs, a critical guide with menus and all price ranges. We're going to be talking about food and about restaurants, and we'll be opening up the phones in just a few minutes for any questions that you may have. Elaine Tate, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
What do you think the qualifications of a good restaurant reviewer should be?
Well, I think that a restaurant reviewer should know, first of all, what goes into good food. I mean, from a kitchen cooking standpoint, you should be able to cook. You should be able, or if not to cook, to be able to say that such and such a recipe should be made with that ingredient and that method, because it's the only way to know if it has been made properly. You can't just say, I know what I like, you know, or I have wonderful taste. You really need a good food background, a food preparation background.
So you have to have eaten a lot, too, and sampled a lot of different foods.
Eaten, and but you also need to study a lot. It requires a lot of book work. I have about 900 cookbooks in my personal collection, and I think I've read most of them and refer to them constantly. I mean, I bone up on it. It's a constant study.
What kind of food background did you come from? What did you eat when you were young?
I ate everything when I was young. I was a very skinny kid, and I had a huge appetite. I say I ate everything. No, I guess I really was picky. I was selective. I wanted only the best fruit. I would not eat fruit in the winter because you didn't get good fruit. I didn't eat the things other children ate. I never ate junk food. I never ate candy and soft drinks and things like that. I mean, I wanted food. My mother was an excellent cook and sort of adventurous cook.
That's unusual. I think most kids prefer the junk food over the finely prepared food.
I never liked junk food. I didn't even like ice cream, which
oh,
is strange.
An unusual yes. Childhood. What kinds of foods did you grow into, like when you started to become, well, before you became a professional writer about food, what kind of training did you have or experience?
Well, I'm a graduate home economist, but that was, my major was fashion design. I kept electing food courses and writing courses because it never occurred to me you could make a living writing about food. But food was my major hobby, my major interest. It just, I kind of fell into the food writing job. But I have the college background, you know, in food preparation. I know why things work chemically, why they work, and why they don't work.
Mm-hmm. When you go into a restaurant, do you think people usually know who they're serving?
I hope not. And one of the problems of having this book is that I have been seen more. Up until this past year, really, I was kind of an invisible person. No one saw me very much. Now I've been doing, autograph things for the book and television and radio and so on. And I've been photographed a little bit more. So I think what I have to do at the end of this year is to change my image, just try to look different. I think that disguises do not work. But there are a few little techniques for not being recognized. And one of them is to just go in and don't look like you're hiding. I went into a restaurant one time, and when the chef walked by, and I thought he might recognize me, I bowed my head. And, of course, he recognized me immediately, and he said, that the reason he did was because people want to be recognized in restaurants. And because I didn't, I was so obvious, I stood out. So now I just try to be just like everyone else. I don't slink. I walk head high.
Does it work?
Usually, yeah. And when it doesn't, I say so in my review. Or I will go back another time. I won't write about it that time. If it's so obvious to me that they're really putting on a special show for me, I just I won't write about it.
I've read that in some restaurants, the pictures of the food writers in the city are hung up in the kitchen so that if they walk in, you can spot them right away.
Well, I've changed the way I look so many times over the years. I mean, I had blonde hair for about, I guess about 10 years, and every shade of blonde. I have it sort of reddish now. It'll probably be another color beginning of next year. So, and I find I have sort of a what I call any face. I really don't think, I mean, I have not a terribly distinctive face. And with a change of hairdo and a change of partner, it isn't as obvious to the restaurants. I get recognized once in a while, but not much.
You probably would really be happy. It already is good, but probably the better the restaurants are in Philadelphia, the happier you are. And I think some people who would want to ensure that the quality of something is good would see themselves as being a booster of just writing positive things all the time. Do you think that it's appropriate for a food reviewer to be a booster of the restaurants in that city as opposed to being critical?
I think that the biggest boost that I or anyone ever gave to Philadelphia restaurants was back 16 years ago when they weren't very good, there weren't very many of them, was to be critical and say, look, you're not very good. And I wrote constantly kind of saying, this isn't good, that isn't good, it's, you know. And but when I found a good restaurant, which happened rarely, and wrote about that, the response was overwhelming, and people became aware that if you had a good product, that you got favorable publicity. If you had a bad one, watch out. And I think really it was kind of a policing system. So I think that more of a policing system than a boosting system is. I mean, I really feel that is much more my function.
You've really seen a lot of very dramatic changes in Philadelphia since you've been writing. How would you characterize what we've come to call the Philadelphia restaurant renaissance?
Well, I think what started it all really was the Julia Child, the interest that she started in French cooking and making it accessible, and then we got a lot of very dedicated amateurs doing restaurants, and from that they were cookbook cooks. They just experimented, and they discovered that people would try a variety of new things. And I think they have opened up Philadelphia's awareness to new foods, to new eating experiences. And now I really see no limit. We have become a very adventurous restaurant town. People will try new things. It's very exciting.
Do you think that there's a majority of a certain kind of restaurant in Philadelphia? Do you feel that we have a good variety in price range and food style?
For a while, I thought we had kind of hit a plateau, and where we had a lot of restaurants that were in the same kind of price bracket, and they were similar in type in that they were this cookbook type restaurant, this or storefront, hanging plant kind of thing, and it was a $15 to $25 a person meal, and they were all interesting, but they were all somewhat the same. Now I think we've started to really round out the restaurant picture. We have some of the better ethnic restaurants, and we're also getting some of the little lower priced neighborhood ethnic restaurants, which I feel is really just the final step in making us a truly great restaurant city.
There's all these hidden places in Manhattan where if you know the right places, you can get an incredible buy. Like for $6, you can get an amazing meal that's not only beautifully prepared but will really fill you up for a couple of days.
Mexican food.
Yeah, or Spanish food. Yeah. Do you think there's many places like that in Philadelphia?
They're coming. I'm starting to see them now. And for the past maybe 2 years, I was a little discouraged because we didn't have them, but now I see them. And they're moving into other neighborhoods. That's how they can do it. They're moving into the sort of developing neighborhoods like West Philadelphia and Fairmount and Queen Village is no longer developing; it's developed. But I mean, in was it Bella Vista down there? And I really find that to be really, you know, the most interesting thing that's happening with restaurants right now.
You think the center city rents dictate high prices?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, though. It hasn't discouraged restaurants from moving there because the Chinese restaurants, several very nice Chinese restaurants have moved into the center city area and are charging higher prices and are getting away with it because it's an elegant kind of setting and it's a different kind of customer than the one who would go to Chinatown. So that's sort of a counter trend. They're coming back into town where some of the others are moving out into the out, you know, the outer areas.
Chinese cooking is seeming to have a very dramatic effect on not only the palates but also the cooking styles of Americans now.
It's affecting everything, including French cooking. The nouvelle cuisine is really very much influenced by Chinese. In the simplicity of the presentation, Chinese and Japanese, and also in just the type of seasoning that they use. It's interesting how French cooking is picking up Chinese and Italian nuances now, where before they were so French, they were so afraid to be anything but French.
Armand Alessino was on the show about a couple of weeks ago, and he's the one who wrote The New French Cooking and mm-hmm. has a book on the new international cooking. And he said that he thought that the Chinese cuisine was becoming very popular and that Italian cuisine had replaced French cuisine as being the most exciting international cuisine.
Well, I think that the French won't let that happen. I think that they're just quietly taking the best of the Italian and incorporating it into this new French cooking. Although I think that there's been a lot of interest and excitement in Italian food, particularly Northern Italian. Although now I think that some of the better Southern Italian cooks are coming in and saying, hey, we have good things to do too. But I think that, I feel, is almost waning, I think, the passionate interest in Italian food. For about 2 years, it was just incredible. I mean, that's all anyone talked about. I think it's slowing down a little.
Now, do you know why?
No, I think food is fashionable. People want what's new, and that's no longer new.
It's hard to think of Italian food as being new.
Well, the fact that it was served at dinner parties, at very fashionable dinner parties where only French food would have been served before, and Italian restaurants suddenly became very, very fashionable restaurants. And like all things fashionable, it changes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't say that these restaurants are not going to exist. They're good and they're established, but I think that something new might come along, and it might be South American, because that's new to a lot of people, and it's coming into the Philadelphia area. There are several restaurants, and people want something different.
Are most South American foods very spicy?
Not really. I mean, it's as varied as North American. There's a woman, Elizabeth Lambert Ortiz, who has just written a Latin American cookbook, and she's very influential. And I see that book is being influential. It'll get into the hands of these cookbook restaurant people, and you'll see these things coming into menus.
It'd be interesting if that started influencing French cuisine.
I wouldn't be a bit surprised.
Really?
No.
Yeah. You go, Elaine, and eat in a lot of restaurants. Do you think you get reacted to differently when you're going into a restaurant, when you're there with a friend, or when you're there with a woman friend or a male friend or a lover or a relative? Do you think that, depending on the situation you're walking in, that you're going to get treated differently by the maitre d' and the waiter or
the
waitress?
I have a good woman friend of mine, and I go to New York every year just as, you know, as friends. We spend 3 or 4 days and we eat in New York restaurants. And we've been doing this for 10 years. And every year we go to whatever the newer restaurants is. And we found that this past year we were treated extremely well in all of the restaurants. And we attribute it not to any lack of business on their part. They're not hungry for business. But the fact that we handle ourselves better as two women in a restaurant. There's a kind of an authority that isn't heavy-handed, but it's, I know what I want, and you come in, and no one, even New York maitre d's, challenges that. You know, it has a whole lot to do with your attitude, really. And I think that I don't find myself being treated shabbily in many restaurants anymore. I mean, this I mentioned the New York one because it is out of town, and I know I'm not known there, so it's not someone doing it because I'm Elaine Tate and I work for the Enquirer. But I find that generally for women, it's better to be with a man, that a man brings you a certain amount of respect from the restaurant people. Although I think restaurants are being run by a younger group of people, and younger men and women tend to not to differentiate and to treat people, you know, fairly. I mean, men and women fairly, and I think that's a change that I'm noticing also.
Do you find the check being put in the middle of the table more frequently instead of right under the man's nose?
Well, I find that I do pay the check all the time when I'm doing reviews, and I frequently do reviews with men. And I find that first of all, the men are a lot less self-conscious about letting me do it. I have one friend who is 66 years old, and he absolutely dies every time I try to pick up the check. But most of them realize that it's a legitimate business thing, and they're comfortable with it. And but the waiters nowadays aren't as disconcerted about handing it to me. The man always just kind of defers to me, and the waiter just looks up and smiles, and hands it to me.
Do you ever eat out alone?
Yeah, I do. And again, usually when I'm out of town. And once in New York, I walked into a restaurant, and I was looked at very coldly by the maitre d', and he said, "A table for one, madam?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "There will be a long wait." And I said, "I will wait." And about 30 seconds later, he came back, and he said, "Ah, madam," he said, "you're so lucky. We have a table for you." And I said, "I knew you would." And he seated me, and I had a very lovely meal. So I think you just have to kind of brave it.
What was all that about?
Well, I think he just didn't want me to hold up a table, and they didn't want to bother with a single woman, and he was hoping I'd go away, and I wasn't. I obviously was not going to go away. I would have sat there till they closed, but he was going to serve me, and he knew it, and he did, and it was fine.
But does it make you feel good to know that when you're mistreated like that, that you have a certain amount of power?
Oh, it's wonderful. Yeah, people say, "Why don't you complain when you're in a restaurant when you're doing a review?" I never complain. I don't have to, because I feel that if they're going to do that, they should do it on me and really and then have to face up to it in print later, because they'll do it to other people, and those people won't have any way of getting any kind of justice out of it. No, I love that.
Yeah. Do you feel self-conscious when you're eating it alone? Sometimes you don't know what to do with your eyes.
No.
Unless you have a magazine with you or something. And you can't, read a magazine when you're eating in an expensive restaurant.
I don't do that, though. I look at my food, and I enjoy it, and I look out at the restaurant. I don't know. It doesn't make me self-conscious. It may make the other people around me self-conscious, because I am watching what they're doing to a certain extent. I try not to stare. But I was on vacation in the Cotswolds in England, and I was like 3 or 4 days by myself in a dining room, and I never picked up a book once. I was too fascinated by everything else. And I sort of make it a point not to do that. I don't want to hide. I have every bit as much right to be there as anyone else.
When I was really young and I'd go out to eat with my family, I used to get really depressed if someone was eating alone at the restaurant, because I would just assume that they were alone because there wasn't anyone in the world who they could take with them to the restaurant.
Yes, but we all know so many people now who are totally self-contained and like being alone.
Yeah.
I happen to like being alone once in a while myself. And I think the expression you have on your face can tell people a lot about whether you're enjoying it or not.
Why don't we open up the phones,
sure,
Elaine? And if you have any questions, you're welcome to give us a call. Our number is 387-6660. My guest is Elaine Tate, the food editor for The Enquirer. And she also has a new book called Best Restaurants in Philadelphia, and it's a book of descriptions and of menus of some of the restaurants in and around Philadelphia. If you have any questions you'd like to ask Elaine, we're at 387-6660. If you're dialing from outside of Philadelphia, our area code is 215, and our lines are open now. When you take someone with you to a restaurant to do a review, will they be in your review at all?
Yeah, but I try not to to get too specific about the other person. And I also don't always give them, a lot of times they will be so anxious to please that they will either be overcritical or undercritical. So I can usually tell, and I taste what they're eating. That's kind of an agreement we have beforehand, that I'm allowed to taste. And of course, they're allowed to taste what I have too. I mean, but if it's a question of they're saying, "Oh, everything is just wonderful," and I know it isn't, I will say that they said it was wonderful, but in my opinion, it was undercooked, overcooked, overseasoned, underseasoned, whatever.
Do you ask to have any input in what your companion's ordering? If there's, say, two main courses that you'd really like to taste,
I will suggest to them that there are two, and which of these two would you prefer? Or do you have, you know, I mean, is there another, is something else that you absolutely must have? But I can be pretty persuasive. And that's another condition that we agree to beforehand, that it isn't a party, it's a working arrangement.
Okay, I just want to say that our lines are open at 387-6660. Before we go to the phones, let me just say something I neglected to mention before, that I'd rather not have you call about specific restaurants. No proper names of restaurants in your comments, okay? Thanks. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air. Hi, go ahead.
Yes?
Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air now.
Okay. I was wondering if Elaine Tate has trouble keeping up with all the new restaurants that are opening. There's so many, it seems like there's a new place on Locust Street, a Brazilian restaurant, I believe, and so many other places, like in Society Hill and all around. Do you have trouble keeping track?
Well, we actually, there are, let's see, the Inquirer has three restaurant reviewers, and we have...
Collins reviewed, I saw the Fairmount restaurant.
Yeah, well, he also, I think he also did the Brazilian one. If it isn't in, it'll probably be in. I'm sure he'll love me for saying that it's coming up. But we find out about a lot of them from readers. We find out from John Corr helps us with a lot of them, because he doesn't need to be anonymous. He kind of roams around town, and he really has a good kind of finger on the pulse of the whole restaurant business, and he does tip us off. So I don't think we miss too many of them. And also, you know, the Inquirer is sort of a big organization, and people in the Inquirer live in various neighborhoods around town, and they tell us, too.
Yeah, and speaking of New York, have you ever been to Ted Hook's backstage?
In New York?
Yeah, New York. It's off Faith Avenue. It's 45th Street.
No, I have not. I don't get to New York as often as
I am. Famous restaurant. I was there last week.
Listen, I should say we're trying to keep away from proper names during
this.
Okay,
well, that's in New York anyway. I don't think anyone would hear it. It's not even advertised. It's not very... It's more of a theatrical restaurant. Theatrical people go there. And you think it's getting... I think it's improving a lot in Philadelphia. I think they're getting a lot better than they used to be a few years ago. You find a lot more restaurants in medium price ranges, too.
Yes, that's what I just said. I think that's a real improvement.
Yeah. Okay, listen, thanks a lot for calling. Have a nice day. Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Hi. My comment about eating out, my wife and I eat out considerably. And one of the things that bothers she and myself is the fast foods, such as the foiled wrapped baked potato, constantly, no matter where you go in the United States. And then the instant mashed potatoes, the packaged... you know, like the Betty Crocker instant cake mixes and stuff like that. And a lot of the so-called very good restaurants, and I hear no one who is a food editor even mentioning anything about that. And my wife and I, we go out to have an experience, and we look at one another and look at the food and look at one another and say, my gosh, I could make this better at home than coming here. That's what I'd like you to address yourself to. The instant.
Well, I haven't seen a foil wrap baked potato in quite a long time. I find that there are many, many restaurants that offer food that is cooked to order or a lot more interesting. I think that kind of thing has kind of is going out rather than coming in. I think most of the newer restaurants tend to pride themselves on fresh food, and they have found that there is a very big audience for this sort of thing, and they're passionate shoppers. You see them down in the food distribution center, you know, selecting the best green bean and so on. So I think, you know, the type of restaurant you're talking about exists, but
it exists in great numbers.
Yeah, but it's kind of a, you know, it's for me, it's so easy to just pick out a restaurant that's going to do that sort of thing and to avoid it. And I think that's your vote, avoiding it.
Do you feel, Elaine, that you can walk into a restaurant and have a sense of whether their vegetables are going to be canned or fresh and whether their potatoes are going to be instant whipped real? Well, how can you tell about the interior? I mean, is there a sense of ambience that you can pick up on?
There's a certain kind of plastic restaurant manual decor that to me is a tip-off. You know, the fake bricks and things like that. I mean, you just know. I don't find that many of them. I guess I just...
I guess you frequent a lot of the other types of restaurants, but my wife and I, we travel around the United States, and from Maine to Florida, we took a month out and just meandered down. Mm-hmm. We found only one decent restaurant that we really, really liked, and that was in McClellanville, South Carolina.
Well, you're not getting off the highways enough. That's it. You're taking
off the highway.
Really?
I'm getting way off the highway, but it's been my experience just meandering around and just hitting a place that looks pretty good and just going in and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, you need a good restaurant guide is what you need.
But none of you people ever really address yourself to the preparation of the food. You tell how nice it tastes and that type of thing.
Well, we have food sections for that, 2 a week, and we do address ourselves to food preparation and that. It's a whole other ballgame, though.
Well, okay.
Okay, well,
I think I'm losing the battle. I'll see you later.
Better luck in your tours. Bye bye. Our number's 387-6660. If you'd like to give us a call, if you have any questions, my guest is Elaine Tate, the food editor for The Enquirer. The number again is 387-6660. And again, I ask you to not refer to the names of specific restaurants. We're trying to stay away from that. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yes, I heard you talking about ethnic restaurants, and since I'm new in town, I wondered if there are any Hungarian restaurants in town, since I'm from Hungary originally.
There is. There is a small one, and we're not allowed to mention restaurants.
Well, how can I find out about it?
Well, call me at the Enquirer.
Oh, but there is a Hungarian restaurant.
Yes, yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for calling. Bye-bye. Let's talk a little bit about prices. That's one of the most significant factors that determine whether or not you're going to go into a restaurant. Some restaurants charge a lot of money for their main courses and such, maybe $15 and up, which to me seems pretty sizable. How do you determine what's a fair price when you're eating? Like, how much should ambience and service and delicacy of preparation figure into the price?
It should very definitely figure into it. There is no way in the world that someone can give you a brocade chair, sterling silver, a beautiful crystal, and charge you what a steakhouse will charge you for a paper plate. I mean, obviously, that's going to have to be paid for somewhere, and you should take that into consideration. You should also decide. You should weigh. What's important to you. Sometimes you want it all, and then you should really be prepared to pay premium price. I have to mention a specific restaurant as an example. I think Le Bec Fan, which charges now, I think, $46 a person, gives you, for that $46, an experience that you just can't duplicate anywhere else. It's a combination of the best ingredients. I sometimes can buy the same quality, and it's expensive. They buy the best. They throw away things that are not absolutely perfect or send it back. They spend a lot of time on it, and they're experts. They have some of the best talent in town. That man has a chef. He also does, Georges Perrier also cooks for the restaurant, and he has a pastry chef, a full-time pastry chef. Now, you know, someone has to pay those salaries. And, you know, if you want that experience, you're going to have to pay you $46. I happen to think if you have the money, it's a good value. If you don't, obviously, it's insane.
Do you think that the more you pay, the more right you have to be really demanding, you know, and to set something back even quicker if it's not perfect?
As long as you know what you're talking about. I've seen people who are demanding and asking for absolutely ridiculous things. And I mean, if you come in and say, I don't know, just pick about some really inane thing, I think they have a perfect right to be unhappy with you. You can, you know, I think you have to be educated as to what you can expect.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Our number is 387-6660 if you'd like to give us a call. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Oh, good afternoon. I'm just calling to comment on Elaine's remarks about the problems of getting service for one in a restaurant.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's not just women who have that problem. Single men, men who go in alone, very often have the same problem, especially in restaurants that are fairly busy. Seems like they just don't want to serve one person at a time.
Do you eat alone frequently?
Whenever I have to stay late in the office, generally, yes. I think of one particular incident some years ago in San Francisco where they just flat out refused to seat me, and I was fortunate in being able to make contact with another solo diner, and we teamed up, and they seated us immediately.
Hmm. I think I'd come back with my partner would be a lawyer probably when I came back. I've heard from somebody at a speaking engagement that I did recently that there are restaurants in other parts of the country, and I think now there's one in New Jersey, where they have a large table where singles can kind of come and go, and it's no matching you up with anybody else. It's just very friendly and easy. And I think it sounds like a good idea, and I suspect more restaurants are going to get into that.
Well, I hope so, because I can still remember the airport in Chicago where they just, after I sat down, they ignored me for almost three quarters of an hour, and finally I got the message and just got up and left. It is a problem, and it seems to be fairly common.
Do you know what one of the problems is if they do pair you up with someone? They're right across the table, and there's always this problem of making eye contact. It's like being in an elevator or on a train.
Yeah. Or in a plane.
Or in a plane, yeah, where you don't really want to be staring at someone, but if they're sitting right across from you, what alternatives do you have?
Well, I guess you just sort of have to swallow or bite the bullet or whatever the proper term is and start a conversation. It probably is less painful that way than eating and staring at your food.
Yeah. Listen, thanks a lot for calling.
You're quite welcome.
Okay, bye-bye now. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yes, I have a question about what to do when you get really bad service in a restaurant. The example I had in mind was once when I went out with several people, and they burned my steak, and I didn't get it till about a half an hour later after everyone else had finished eating. Another time I had wine spilled on my suit.
Wow. And when they burned the steak, did they replace it with another steak, and that's the one that came later? Or?
Yes, they did replace it.
Uh-huh.
They explained to me, your steak is burned, we'll cook another one for you. And it came about a half an hour later after everyone else had been served.
Yeah, well, I don't really know what they could do in a situation like that. I think that by at least replacing the steak, they at least showed that they were interested in having you be pleased. I don't know how they could have gotten one to you any faster once they had all the other meals out. And as far as getting the wine spilled on me, I would certainly have insisted that they paid for the cleaning. I had some wine spilled on a handbag one time, and the waitress was so nice about it that she said, if you can't get it out, I will buy you another handbag. Well, she was so apologetic about it that I ended up saying, oh, no, please, I'll take care of it myself. So I have never really had that kind of experience, but I would have insisted that they take care of it, the management
okay,
take care of it.
You do think it's proper to ask then?
Oh, I do, yes, sure.
Okay, that answers my question. Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yes, first of all, I'd just like to say I enjoy reading Elaine.
Thank you.
And I guess my question is, we hear a lot locally about the restaurant renaissance. I was just wondering, does Elaine, when talking to writers, food writers, and maybe travel editors from other parts of the country, are they getting the word about Philadelphia? And is our
are they ever?
Is our image improving because of that?
Well, I was the co-chairman of a food writers, professional food writers meeting here in Philadelphia in June, and we had 60 newspaper food writers from all over the country, and they were just dazzled. They really were. They loved the whole experience, and in fact, we intimidated them so much that no one wants to have the next meeting because they're all afraid that it will just look shabby in comparison to what they had in Philadelphia.
That's good. It's good to hear.
Yeah, and I think our Convention and Tourist Bureau is doing a very good job right now.
Mm-hmm.
they're just constantly spreading the word, and you know, they bring travel people in, and I think we're starting to really make the big time. People are starting to say nice things about Philadelphia all over the country.
That's good to hear. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling. Bye-bye. Our number is 387-6660 if you'd like to give us a call, and there are some open phone lines now. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yes. I just have a historical question. I was told by somebody that that the Cordon Bleu school of cooking in France was founded by Italian chefs from northern Italy. Is there any truth to that?
I don't know. Isn't that terrible? I really don't know.
Princess or something was...
Yeah, well, Armand Alessino had said... Armand Alessino had said on the show that Catherine de' Medici took to France with her a lot of the Italian cuisine, and that was really an important part of forming the haute cuisine in France.
Well, royalty has always kind of spread the gospel of good food. I know in Scandinavia they have French influences again from the royal marriages and bringing their staffs.
They traveled with their staff.
Yes.
I see.
So that's really all of the cuisines are kind of intermarried.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
Bye now.
Bye bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I would like to ask you a question about South American food. Is it basically hot and spicy, or...?
No, it's as varied as any other type of food. I think that's people misunderstand. They think it's like Mexican food, very hot and peppery. Spanish food is not hot at all. Very little of it is highly seasoned.
And what kind of products do they use that are any different than generally speaking?
There's a lot of fruit and things like that. Nuts. It would be kind of difficult to different. The peppers are used, but sparingly.
Mm-hmm.
Different vegetables. But it's not. It's really not that exotic. It's just the combinations are different. The spices, I think, are what are different more than anything.
The spices are different. I see. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling. Bye bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yes, I'd like to ask Ms. Tate, what's the criteria for the rating system, I guess, of rating restaurants and everything?
Well, I dislike a rating system. At one point at the Enquirer, we had stars, and I fought the whole time to get out of that, because I think that what it does is any kind of symbol... makes people they just read the symbol and they judge the restaurant on that. And when I write a review, I want you to know a lot of things about it, and for you to make that judgment yourself. I don't want to judge it for you. I want to tell you what I found, and then I want you to read that and read it carefully, and then to make up your mind about it. And a rating system makes up your mind for you.
Yeah. In other words, they kind of puts.
It says this is good or this is bad, this is black or this is white, and that's not the way it is.
That's true. But does your judgment make value judgments, per se, on, you know, any particular restaurant, or is it...
Oh, I try not. I just try to go in and describe what I find, and based on a lot of experience.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't try to say this is good or this is bad.
Yeah. You try to do you weigh all the alternatives? As far as, you know, this aspect is good and this aspect is bad, and
yeah, because sometimes you go to a restaurant and you really go for the for the way you feel there, for the service and so on. And I mean, I've gone to restaurants where I know the food isn't as good as another place that I might go to in the same area, but I go there because it's a beautiful day and I want to see the boats on the river.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
That's good. Okay,
listen, thanks a lot for calling.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Hello?
Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
I wonder, I'm addressing Ms. Tate here. What is your position on the so-called truth in menu labeling or menu misrepresentations? Such, do you think that there should be some kind of local legislation regulating that kind of practice, you know, where items are listed as fresh or homemade or from certain geographic origins and they're actually not.
I think that
certain cities, I think like Los Angeles, have some kind of truth in menu labeling requirements on the menu.
I think it's a wonderful idea, and I think it's long overdue, really. I would love to see it come to Philadelphia, and if there were any way that I could have any influence on that, I'd like to do it.
Does your column or do you food editors kind of push for that kind of thing or not?
Well, they certainly. I think the public certainly knows where we stand on issues like that.
They do.
I think so.
Well, okay.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Elaine, what kind of stipulations would you want to see?
Well, I certainly would want to distinguish between fresh and frozen, and also, as he said, homemade, if it is truly homemade. And I can't offhand think of other. Geographic locations. If it's from Nova Scotia, you want to know it's from Nova Scotia and not from somewhere else. I mean. Rock lobster tails can be from a lot of different places. Shrimp can be from a lot of different places. I'd like to be able to know where they came from.
Mm-hmm. Okay, listen, we'll have time for one more phone call. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yeah, Terry, how you doing?
Okay.
I have a sort of a comment there for Elaine. My wife and I were in Paris this year, and we did something we've always wanted to do. Was Zita Tour d'Argent.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if Elaine ever ate there and what you thought of it.
No, I'm sorry, I haven't. I've eaten at a lot of places in Paris, but that isn't one of them. I'd like to someday. I'm told that it's an experience.
That it was.
Yeah.
That it was. We even got a little card with the number. We got the duck, which is their specialty,
mm-hmm.
and we even got a little card with the number of our duck that they've served since they've been open. It was really incredible.
Were you happy with the rare duck?
Well, I'll tell you, to be perfectly honest with you, the service was really outstanding,
uh-huh.
but I don't think the food was any better than a prominent Philadelphia French restaurant
uh-huh.
on Bruce Street
uh-huh.
that we go to a lot.
Yes, okay.
I don't think the food was as good as that,
uh-huh.
to be really frank.
Can you imagine if you went to McDonald's and they gave you the number of the hamburger that they were selling? 3 billion, 3 million?
You'd need a big card.
Bigger than the hamburger.
Yeah.
Think of the prestige attached to it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, if you get there, you must try it, though. It really is an experience. The view from the top, from the restaurant alone is worth the price.
Yeah, I think that's important, things like that.
Yeah, it really is.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for calling.
Right.
Bye-bye. Elaine, I have to ask you about tipping. Everyone isn't sure if they're leaving the right amount. How do you tip?
Well, for the Inquirer officially, since I'm on their expenses, I tip 15% if the service is adequate. What I do on my own, if I'm just out, you know, enjoying dinner on my own, I tend to tip sometimes a little more for better service. It's just my way of saying thank you. I've worked as a waitress. That's part of my experience, and that gives you a very good picture of the problems that waiters and waitresses have, and I think that it's absolutely immoral when people stiff the waiter or the waitress for no good reason. I mean, a lot of times I think the waiter or waitress is blamed for something that is entirely not their fault at all.
It seems to me when I go out to eat with someone who has been a waiter or a waitress or has a waiter or a waitress in their family, that they always tip more than 15%.
Yeah.
They usually tend to tip 20 if they have waiters around.
I'd say 20, except that the cost of food has gotten so high that 20% on a restaurant bill now is a chunk.
Yeah.
And sometimes you really can't afford to do it. I think that 15 is certainly a minimum. For adequate service.
Since so much of your professional life is tied up with food, do you have to watch your weight? You said you were skinny when you were a kid.
I was skinny when I was a kid, and then at 16 I started, chunking up. And I have always had to watch my weight since then, but I find that it's eating in restaurants is not the problem. It's when I get preoccupied. Like when I was writing this book, I found I was doing three projects at once, the book, and I had this food writers conference coming to Philadelphia, and I had another journalism thing that I was working on. And I couldn't think about what I was eating, and I was eating like a robot, just putting food in my mouth in between meals and not eating intelligently, eating junk food. And that I gained weight, and I just lost 17 pounds because I had to. That was the weight I put on from being careless.
Do you cook a lot yourself?
I love to cook, yeah, and I do. I cook for myself. And I don't mind cooking when I'm by myself at all.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I'm entertained by it. I find it very relaxing. I also cooked, we had a thing at the Inquirer a week or 2 weeks ago, I guess, and I prepared, I did it as a project for the paper, I prepared food for 75 people for less than $100.
Wow.
And I did it in a day and a half, working day and a half, and that included shopping and everything else. So I like projects like that. I enjoy that.
Was it a potluck dinner, or did you?
No, it was a pretty classy thing. I've forgotten how many courses we had, but it looked impressive. And of course, newspaper people are wonderful to cook for because they're always hungry and they eat everything. I mean, they ate everything but the plates. It was great.
You're lucky they didn't eat the plates.
Yeah, well.
So the holidays are coming up. Are you going to be doing a lot of elaborate cooking or eating then?
I have a thing about holidays. I find that most people just really overdo it with cakes and cookies and things like that, and they stuff guests, and guests feel embarrassed because they're not eating all these things. We just had a party at my house. A group of us all contributed. It was a covered dish kind of thing, only it was a very elegant Edwardian covered dish. We had each person brought something very elegant, and that was our major holiday entertainment. The rest of the time, I'll just have white wine or something light, or I may on New Year's do a bouillabaisse or something like that, but simple, you know, not no cakes, no cookies. I just think people get tired of it.
Mm-hmm.
Last year we had a pasta party over the holidays, which it was refreshing for everybody because they had been so, stuffed with Christmas, traditional Christmas things, and everybody was grateful for a linguine with clam sauce, you know, rigatoni.
Well, Elaine, I hope you have a really good holiday. I want to thank you for being here. It's really been fun to have you here.
It's fun for me.
I've been speaking to Elaine Tate, and she's the food editor for The Enquirer. She also has a book out now about Philadelphia restaurants. It's called Best Restaurants in Philadelphia and Its Environs, and it's a menu of descriptions of restaurants as well as examples of their menus. And Elaine, thanks again for being here. And thanks also to all of you who called this afternoon. This is Fresh Air. You're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Thank you.
very clear. Our love is here to stay. Not for a year, but ever and a day. The radio, the telephone, all the movies that we know may just be passing fancies, and in time may go. But oh my dear, our love is here to stay. Together we're going a long, long way. In time the Rockies may crumble, Gibraltar may tumble, they're only made of clay. But our love, hey, our love is here to stay. It's very clear, our love is here to stay. Not for a year, but ever and a day. The radio, the telephone, and the movies that we know may just be passing fancies, and in time may go. But oh, oh my dear, our love is here to stay. Together we're going a long, long way. Gibraltar may tumble, they're only made of clay. Hey, our love is here to stay. Do 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 do.
Anita O'Day, and before that we heard tenor saxophonist Scott Hamilton with Dave McKenna at the piano. This is Fresh Air. You're listening to WUHY FM in Philadelphia. At 4 o'clock this afternoon on Fresh Air, my guest will be University of Pennsylvania-based sociologist E. Digby Baltzell, and at about 3:40 or so, we'll be joined by someone who's just written a history of Currier and Ives lithography, the 19th century color lithography prints that are just an excellent example of Americana.